Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
It's also another primary day in America. And boy,
we keep having them. Holy cow. But we got what? Florida, Alaska, and Wyoming, right?
Yes. Florida, Alaska, and Wyoming. With, I think, Florida and Alaska being the two most interesting of this, yeah. Obviously. Wyoming, going to put that safely in the Republican camp.
I think that's a fair game.
I don't think we see any plot twists there. Go ahead and put that over there.
I have a good prediction.
Let's start looking at Florida. What are you looking at in the Florida primaries tonight?
I think some of these congressional races are really interesting to me. Florida 20, Florida 25. Obviously, the fate of Corey Mills, a lot of folks are watching, and there's a real credible primary challenger who has, you know, spent a lot of time on broadcast news, so is well known there. And I think if you're a Democrat, you're probably hoping Mills ekes by, because that's a much easier flip if Corey Mills is on the ballot in November. If you're Republicans, I think Mills going away would probably be a great thing for the Republican Party and not having to deal with that as a battleground. But I think some of these other primaries are interesting to me. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is running in a new district, a majority Black Democrat district. So there's been a lot of inter-party tension over that situation there. We'll see how she does. Obviously, very well known, very high name ID, but that's a
former DNC chair.
Former DNC chair. That's an interesting race to look at there on. Florida 25, I think, is where Jared Moskowitz is facing a challenger from one of the Democrat Socialists of America. We've always said that Florida is a different animal when it comes to this particular issue of Israel. And so, I think we're going to find out another ceiling for the DSA, which will be how well they perform in Florida. So I'm curious to see how some of those play out.
Yeah, for me in Florida, what I'm watching tonight is that Florida 25 race, that Moskowitz-Larkin race, Larkin being the DSA candidate there. And when you look at that, not only is that one of the, last stands of a DSA candidate in this primary season, because we are getting toward the end of it. It ends, early September here. But also, this is now the districts everybody in Florida are running in are the new redrawn congressional districts done by Governor DeSantis in the Florida legislature. This district is supposed to be, soft Democrat. Mm-hmm. Moskowitz holding it. But if Larkin wins, I think there's a case to be made that he is too far from the more moderate Democrat lane that sits in that district that would elect someone like a Jared Moskowitz versus a DSA candidate. I think that seat could become a pickup seat for Republicans in the House and a flip, because that DSA candidate, I don't think, fits that district. So that's something I am completely watching tonight. What else I'm watching is going to be the Fishback flame out. We are going to see a Republican who is running in this primary who has said really heinous things, just begin and end a political career, just like up in smoke like that. Mm-hmm. Byron Donalds, I think, is going to walk away comfortably with that seat. And in Florida, funny enough, this cycle, there seems to be a tendency for people who lost in other places to come and try to win again in Florida. Mm-hmm. One being Chris Collins, fellow former New Yorker, who is now down there trying to run again. Of all the storylines in the country, this is separate from Florida. The comeback of the kickout kid, right? This seems to be a cycle of that where people who have lost before are really trying again. Do you think he has any chance whatsoever?
I don't. I mean, being a carpetbagger is bad enough, but being one who got bounced out of Congress, right? I think it was some SEC issues, if I recall. White collar crime, but I don't think that's going to play too well. I'm pretty sure Floridians are like, we don't need the New York guy to come in here and take our seat. I think there are plenty of other alternatives, really on both sides of the aisle in this case, that will generate more enthusiasm from voters in a more prominent way. And this will be Collins' last gasp. I mean, we've seen a couple folks like recycle their names. I mean, even in South Carolina, right, we had Mark Sanford pop back up for 5 seconds for the Darlene Graham primary.
Stacey Abrams was up for a long time. Charlie Crist has run in every party for every seat, I think, that is available in the state of Florida.
Former perennial candidate Alan Grayson is on the ballot yet again.
Always got the runners who want to make a comeback, and it just doesn't work. And I don't think Florida is going to be any different. But to your point about the DSA as well, Florida is the one state where we have seen socialism and communism as a message work continuously because of the amount of Venezuelans and Cubans in the state. Like I said, that Moskowitz seat, that Larkin guy wins. And this seems like a competitive race. I still think it goes to Moskowitz. But if Moskowitz doesn't win there, and these numbers are so small, you got to look at every race in the country. And that Florida one will be one that I bet you plenty of people will be putting money in to try and bring that one home. And it's not the only primaries we got tonight.
Yeah.
We also have Alaska.
The battle of the Dan Sullivans.
Dan v. Dan.
Dan, it's like Dan, is it Dan S. Sullivan? And like the incumbent, obviously, Senator Dan Sullivan, but there is another Dan Sullivan on the ballot.
Who has voted Democrat in the last three presidential elections, attended a No Kings rally, but is now trying to say, no, I'm not a Democrat plant. I'm totally a Republican trying to run in good faith in this primary.
It can't help. His name's Dan Sullivan, you know?
I mean, you shenan once, you're going to shenan again. And if that isn't the Democrat Party right here, come on. These are reindeer games. And that wasn't in Alaska.
Yeah. Okay, we've gone off the rails now.
I'll see myself out. Thank you so much for being here all week.
Have a good weekend, everybody. Oh, my gosh. Yes, I love the shenanigans because they call it the silly season for a reason. And, we talked about this last week. Like, Alaskans, they know their stuff. They can literally spell Murkowski on a ballot if need be. So I think they won't be fooled, but it's been kind of hilarious.
But if Mary
Pelota.
Pultola. Yeah, Pitola. How do you say it?
Mary Pultola. Yeah. Paletta Pulitzer.
There's an L, yeah, we're really good at this pronouncing game. What do you think there's a threshold she has to hit tonight that would scare Republicans going into the general election?
No. She's going to win. She's going to get obviously be the nominee. I'm never one of those. I know one of the popular talking points on both parties is anytime someone doesn't really clear 50+1 on their side of the ledger, it's like, oh, they're potentially vulnerable. Look, there's something going on there. I think because we've all known for a long time, it's going to be Sullivan versus Mary. like the bell rings after Labor Day. I think anything that happens before that is just performative.
Do you think Alaska is one of those stunner races that one of the reach races the Democrats can go for this November? Or are you looking at the map and saying, maybe hold the money there? Maybe we still got a fighting chance in, say, Michigan, where I think that race has now come into a toss-up category by Fox News, who also moved Texas into a toss-up category for the Senate. So it moved two races in kind of the opposite directions here.
The thing that's appealing about Alaska, I'll say, is it's really cheap to play there. Like, it's not going to cost you as much as a Michigan or a Texas, frankly. And so you're talking about, compared to some of these other seats that we're playing in, not as much money that covers a lot more ground. So it's worth investing in. You're not going to have to go for broke there either. And again, I think that as this campaign really kicks off, I think that by the beginning of October, we'll really have a sense of like, okay, how legitimate of a threat, you know, is Mary to Dan, right? Like how good of a campaigner is she really now that we're back down to the 1v1 race? I think oftentimes people overlook like raw talent and you either have it or you don't. You know, the socialist in Wisconsin lost in part because she's just not as talented as Syed is in terms of communicating and being on the stump. Like people can say what they want about Syed. He's a strong communicator. That's part of the reason why he won in Michigan. Hong lost in Wisconsin because she's not that impressive as a communicator, in my opinion, at all. If Mary can show that she's got some chops, that encourages that investment, you know, from the Democrats at a national level. If she's kind of unimpressive and once the race is really narrowed and everyone is now looking and hyper scrutinizing the campaign, which is what's going to happen, we've now are going to narrow the map and the attention of the entire political media world is going to go down to 5 or 6 states on the Senate side that will determine whether or not the majority is really in jeopardy. How these campaigns and candidates respond to that narrowing and that scrutiny, where every moment matters, every public engagement matters, every interview you do actually matters, and there are perils with each one of those. How they navigate that pressure will tell us whether or not they're worth that investment come October.
Here's the other question, though. She's getting skittish already, right? Kamala Harris put out an endorsement email for her, a fundraising email that would have had to have been cleared by both sides here. And then Alaska was like, wait, what do you mean Kamala Harris? And Mary's like, what, me? No, I didn't ask for that Kamala support email. I also think that makes it harder for Democrats to try to play their hand in Alaska, because Kamala still, like it or lump it for Democrats, polling-wise, is still considered a leader in the Democrat Party and a frontrunner for 2028. Yep. We both know
that's a little
bit of that's name ID, but it is that she was the former vice president. She ran last cycle. All of those things can be true. I don't have, and then Pelota, she fired a bunch of her campaign
staff. A bunch of her team.
Layered people as well. That's not the sign of a strong campaign. Don't get me wrong. There are plenty of campaigns and plenty of strong campaigns that after they win the primary, they bring in heavier hitters. And they do that and they layer staff, which is annoying if you're that staffer. I mean, the Francesca Hong campaign was measuring the drapes about how they were going to make campaign changes in their office before she even won the primary. I mean, the night before, the morning of the election, there was an email, a political playbook has big shakeup coming up. When it comes to reach races, I still feel Alaska's a bridge too far for Democrats, and not because this isn't a target-rich environment right now. I think the map is shifting under our feet in real time in a lot of ways, especially on that Michigan race. But her squeamishness about the Democrat establishment when she might need some outside money to come in and help her and to have those voices in her corner, she's scared of her shadow in a state where sometimes it's daylight all day long. You can't have that when you're trying to run for the U.S. Senate in Alaska. I think even her problems within the Democrat establishment is going to make it harder for her to win in November if they're looking at where they want to put their money on the map.
Yeah, I feel like, fortune favors the bold. And I've never believed in doing things from a defensive posture. I don't think you run away from anything. I think that's generally tactically a mistake. I do think that regardless of what happens here in August, if we get down to the final month and it's truly competitive, every candidate on both parties will have the financial resources they need to make their case. I think there's going to be so much money flying around, and no one's going to want to leave any ammunition left in the cannons there. They're going to leave it all on the field. So if there's a snowball's chance that she could get the job done, the money will materialize somewhere. Somehow that's part of how our system works now with dark money and super PACs. Like people will find the money if it's legitimately in play. If I were advising her campaign, and I'm not, if I were advising her campaign, I would tell her, like, don't run away. Like, that's the biggest mistake you can make in politics, is to run away from shit. Like, if the former vice president of the United States is going to help you raise money, then okay. Take every dollar. You're going to need it.
I mean, leave me with a dose of healthy skepticism that money is going to appear for her in the Democrat establishment if this becomes a competitive race at the end. I think the money, if they become resource tight, is going to go to Michigan if they think that's closer, because that state's an early voting state in the 2028 cycle. And money for Democrats, when it's come to outside money on the national level, has been much harder to get this cycle. So I think I hear your point. Money always comes around sometimes if you need it, especially if you look like you're about to win or you could be winning. Man, doesn't that help open up donor checkbooks for you? I just think that this is one that's too far. But speaking of healthy skepticism, we know a recent story that's been going on this week is Karen Bass's campaign put out a bunch of information about how she was leading by double digits in this research poll from this group about the primary. Turns out, bogus.
Wasn't real.
Now, my question here, even in all this story, is How often do you think it happens that a fake poll gets put out, moved around like this? Because this same entity put one out for Francesca Hong saying she was going to be up. And now they've admitted that they did it to try and move the narrative, that they wanted to see how much it could matter versus what it was actually going on in reality. How much do you think that happens? Do you think this is an extreme example of that? And do you think it changes the skepticism of polling going forward?
I think that versions of this happen all the time. People cherry pick different crosstabs that, you know, people deliberately ask questions in polls that they know are going to provide some positive response that will allow them to go out there and say, look, this is a plausible candidate and a plausible campaign. Massaging the numbers and the questions happens all the time. This is the most extreme example that I've ever actually seen, I think, in my 2-3 decades of doing this, of like, wow, they put out a fake poll basically and then admitted it like a day later. It's like,
yeah,
wow.
I mean, I remember growing up in the era where you couldn't even put out internal polls and have reporters report on it because they're like, we don't want your numbers. That's not valid. I've seen that model change significantly in reporting. I blame reporters more than I blame anybody else.
Oh,
Karen Bass, her team could be dumb enough to find a poll and say, look at that number. It looks so good. And then do none of the work they should have done to vet the poll. Mm-hmm. That's their own stupid faults. And if you're going to do stupid things, I hope you get caught by reporters. But reporters were so quick to take that poll and to take the Hong poll and be like, whoa, look at these polls. Look at how big this is, without doing their own research. And it took Hong losing last week and this Karen Bass poll for anybody to start asking questions about this. I know that people move narratives with polls. They want to, right? It's a tried and true tactic. I'll say it right now. I think Bruce Blakeman's trying to play that game in New York. I think I see them going out there all the time to the New York Post saying this is a competitive race because they found something that has them within 10 or at 10. And they're trying to say, look, it's competitive because you want to signal to donors and to the public and to voters, wow, there really could be something here. I want to give that money. But I've never seen where reporters took the bait so easily multiple times in multiple races about this. Do you think this adds any skepticism to either polling or to reporters moving forward?
Well, it should. It won't, but it should. You know, I think that what we've seen now, and this is where the media puts their thumb on the scale in a way that is really disingenuous, frankly. Like what we saw in Michigan, you know, the Al Sayed's going to run away with this and win the primary. And it's like Haley Stevens was within 1 percentage point of him by the time the polls close. Imagine what the narrative would have been had it been covered that way the entire time, that it was a real true horse race toss up. Anybody could win this thing. It would have changed the way the last couple of weeks of that campaign played out, I think. You know, they got it wrong in Wisconsin, again, predicting a double digit blowout for the socialist. Wasn't the case. They got it wrong by jumping on this bogus poll for Karen Bass. And I think that there needs to be some reckoning here of what meets the criteria, the threshold for actually covering, amplifying, you know, giving oxygen to polls. Like, I don't think that anyone should take anyone's campaign polls, period. I don't think if you're a media
unless
institution,
you're willing to give full crosstabs.
There's got to be complete transparency.
That's the thing, right? I think you can call bluffs on campaigns by saying, sure, we'll run your poll if you give us full crosstabs.
Give us the full thing.
Having worked on plenty of campaigns, Kurt, you know this too. We run a poll internally. We find good numbers on it in one sect of questions where we feel, even if it's a hypothetical, you know, you wouldn't be polling like this now, but earlier in the cycle, you know, it would be me versus generic Democrat. And if those poll numbers are good, you pull that, you take it, you put it in a memo, you email it out, you get a reporter to cover it to try and show that dogfight. But I think, And I would say this is strategist. I would never put out our full crosstabs because we tend to put other questions in there where we're thinking ahead, where we're trying to alleviate for an issue that maybe the public doesn't see or the media is not reporting on. We use polls in a lot of different ways, and we'll put different questions in there that people will never know about,
right?
Because that's not relevant to like the dog, you know, the dog fight, the head to head matchup.
It'd
which
be
is
like publishing like your GPS for the other campaign for your opponent to see, oh, this is what you care about. This is what you're vulnerable about. This is where you're going to hit us. It's like there's so much information that we put in these polls that guide our television spends, our themes, like what we do when we do it. Like you can't put that all out there. And so that's why, like, if you're a media entity that does your own polling, which a lot of these guys do, I don't know why you would report on anyone else's poll at all, ever, except the ones that you commission.
So I will say this. Yeah, if you are an entity, though, you might not do polling, especially in a congressional, right? You're generally only doing polling on major races. If you're doing any race polling, it's usually national polling from the national outlets. It's usually topic polling, you know, right direction, wrong direction.
Right.
So for them to get some sense of polling and what it actually looks like in the race, because, you know, like maybe Siena College in New York will do a poll on a race over there if it looks competitive, or the gubernatorial, and that might be the only polling, but they do that once a quarter, and right now, you know, they'll ramp up a little more. So I understand there's a hole. And
I'm okay with academic institutions doing it. I'm okay with any nonpartisan entity that doesn't have a dog.
I would almost make the argument a good campaign now, if this really does somehow bring in healthy skepticism, right? A healthy skepticism of polling, where they start doing a sub poll of a poll. And they release just that first part, because maybe it's only three questions. You're like, yep, this poll was three questions, and you get that instead of, and then you say, and then we pivoted to this, and that's the rest of your poll. You think I would know more about this being married to a pollster as I'm throwing out these grand theories about how you could.
I can just see Connor sitting there going, like, what is she talking about?
He's like, my wife doesn't do the numbers in our family. No. But you know what I mean? Like, I think there's still a way to play it and try to show what's going on in some of these local races or, you know, more regional races than national. But, like, I hope this puts some healthy skepticism into the polling game, because people need to know, one, the reason you get poll results are because the people who answer them are people who would answer polls about politics.
Exactly. Right there. That skews you, in my opinion. I'm always like, who the hell has time to talk to a pollster and go through 80 questions of shit?
I've done it before to get all the way to the end and be like, wait, who paid for it? I want to know, because I'll like take, I've had it happen before during campaign cycles. I got a polling call last cycle before the Virginia gubernatorial, and I was like, ooh, all right, they've modeled me as like a 37-year-old white female who lives outside D.C., married, no kids. I probably sound like a soft lib. Let's do it. We go all the way through. I was like, I get all the way through. I'm like taking questions, especially on the angles of questions. So I'm like texting them into my colleagues who are on campaigns. And then I was like, wait, who paid for it? I'll do a poll just to figure out who paid for it at the end.
Nerd.
So I can tell all my political friends, being like, so-and-so is in the field right now.
Oh my gosh, you're such a nerd. Can't believe you do
ding,
that.
Dang right. Ding dang right, I am a nerd. And speaking of nerds, let's talk about the message we deliver at the kitchen table. The kitchen table test, if we want to call it that.
Yes.
Because we might be nerds. The primaries might be nerdy because we're watching subsects of votes. Polling might be nerdy because I'm sitting here and you and I are talking about ways that we can still make polling relevant and try to skirt the system to get a message out there. And now we're going to talk about the message that's coming through. And data centers and AI have become absolutely massive this cycle. How much do you think that data centers play in as a table kitchen issue in the midterms?
I think they're becoming huge. I think it actually might be the one issue that skews all party lines, no pun intended, that whether you're Republican or Democrat,
party animals,
whether you're Republican or Democrat, you're like, no on data centers. You don't want them anywhere near your neighborhood, backyard, school, you name it. I think data centers are so underwater. And I think it's become emblematic of the broader challenges and fears that people have with tech, with AI. You know, it has become the physical manifestation of the thing that is sucking up the most oxygen, that is taking up the most resources, that the most money is being spent on. And people just don't know, what do we have to show for it? Like, our lives aren't materially better because these things exist. But our utility bills are higher. our water resources are being used for this, and there's no value proposition for them. And so I think that we're seeing right now Republicans and Democrats across the board change their positions on data centers. Governor Abbott here in Texas just did a whole AI data moratorium data center thing after being very pro data center. Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania today is doing a big 180 on data centers. They've gone from, wow, these things could create a lot of value for our communities, a lot of tax revenue perhaps, to not in my backyard. We're putting a pause on, like, everyone's favorite word now is moratorium, data center moratorium. We got Ro Khanna out in California doing a data center bill of rights. It's like, we have the passenger bill of rights, we'll have the data center bill of rights. It is shockingly, if you would have said this in January, I wouldn't have believed you. It is the number, like, top two issue in a lot of races that I'm seeing. Speaking of polling, like, the issue that's popping up and creating the most passion, where people are not just, oh, I'm somewhat familiar, I've heard of this, I'm wishy-washy. It's like very strong feelings about data centers.
Yeah, I'll start with this. Data centers and AI companies are doing the worst public relations and public affairs campaign I have ever seen. And listen, if y'all want to hire someone, give Kurt and I a call. We'll give you a little bipartisan support on how to message, because this ain't that hard. Mm-hmm. I think that data centers equal global competitiveness to me, in my mind. And they are a kitchen table issue, because as they began to pop up, these local entities, these state governments weren't doing the work to make sure that taxpayers weren't footing the bill for the use of resources, for the cost of infrastructure upgrades to bring these data centers in. Now, I will point to Loudoun County, Virginia, which is an exurb here of the DC area, which is one of the wealthiest counties in the country. Yeah. They also have brought in data centers and seen a huge economic impact, a positive one, to mm-hmm. that county through what data centers have brought in. But bringing in smart regulatory frameworks so that you say, hey, as a data center, not only are we going to come in, but we're going to build enough power for ourselves and to help power part of the community. We're going to make sure that our water resources are taken care of and our infrastructure, we build it on our own, but we're going to help improve yours. And we're going to build a bunch of parks, and we're going to make sure the right. roads look better on the way out to the data center. And we're going to make sure you don't foot the bill, but you get all the benefits. This isn't yes. that hard. But this knee-jerk political reaction we're seeing right now, which is yes, no, yes, no. It's because people are terrified of AI. What do mm-hmm. they hear about AI? It's going to take their jobs. It's going to take over the government. It's so powerful now that we can't even see the most powerful versions because mm-hmm. of their ability to hack and overtake systems. We're hearing stories now about AI going off on its own and hacking into systems right yeah. now. This yeah. is so there is a real fear here of what AI and data centers can do. But our global competitiveness, I think, very much is in lockstep with our ability to produce artificial intelligence in the United States. For what we aren't producing, China doesn't give a rip yeah. where they put a data center or what it does. They will do it if it means global dominance. We can do both here in the United States. We should do both. And candidates and campaigns who aren't appreciating it in that fashion are going to get themselves set up, because we're now seeing AI data centers, this outside entity, they're starting to get super PACs. They're starting to get a little uh-huh. money involved in politics. And it's a kitchen table issue because they haven't been willing to have the conversation. It's the same thing with politicians. They run away scared from having the conversation. Yeah. You're right. I was saying this last night. Yeah. Is there an economic story to be told about what the Trump administration and Republicans have done? Absolutely. You can talk about the largest middle class tax cuts in American history. You can talk about how women, for the first time in American history, are outpacing men in the workforce and in job hiring. That's all great economic stories. But the American people right now are saying, dang, it feels more expensive. It's still harder uh-huh. to afford groceries. What are you doing? And then let's share that message forward, right? We've showed you what we can do when it comes to the economy. Let's show you what we can do again. And that's going to mean the jobs of tomorrow, making sure your kids are going to schools that are getting them educated. If that's trade or a 4-year degree or a 2-year associate's degree, let's get kids the education. That's an economic argument. Talk about, right, there's plenty of stories we can tell moving forward that'll bring voters in. That's just one sect of it. But the same AI companies that are too scared to even say that now have politicians who are too scared to make a decision because it's such a hot and cold kitchen table issue right now that I don't think is getting talked about enough. Yes, people talk about the cost as well, but this seems like a real opportunity for communities if AI and data centers were smarter about it. I think if politicians were too, we're going to put a moratorium in for 60 days and or 90 days until we get past the election day. And here's the framework I want now, right? Be proactive on this. Don't let it sit there.
Yeah. Well, politicians do two things really well, nothing and overreact. And we're seeing that in spades right now. And it's going to be really tough for a lot of these folks who are going to campaign now on no data centers to be able to walk that back when they're in office. And so, I mean, again, I think that the tech companies have done a piss poor job of messaging this. They have lost the narrative. It has gotten completely away from them. And again, when I'm looking at real polling that shows this issue popping up in 1 and 2 and number 1 in intensity of being against it. No one's intensely for it, by the way. It's all bad. That is shocking. And it just tells you what a horrible job the tech companies have done and the arrogance of the tech companies to think that people would just accept it and not scrutinize it and not, be willing to vote people out over it. Like, they did not see this as a kitchen table issue. They saw it as a purely economic tax revenue issue.
Yeah, they saw it similar to crypto where there wasn't really an adversarial force necessarily. Right. They were
And what they didn't understand was, unlike crypto, it'd be one thing if every crypto, issue resulted in a physical bank being built in your town that was the crypto bank. Like, this is a physical manifestation of it. And that's not something we've had before. And now people are catching on. And again, the numbers don't lie. Like, areas that have approved data centers are seeing utility rates go up. Like, that's a very real, it doesn't get more kitchen table than that kind of stuff.
I really think that data centers could do a lot of good. Look at all the open Spirit Halloween stores there are across the country. Those are generally undesirable. No, I'm sorry. I'm just kidding about where they could put them. Those places never seem to stay open more than a few months. I'm sure they'd love that.
Sure they'd love to have a data center popped in there, a little miniature one. I think that this is going to be one of the defining issues, actually, that's going to pop up in exit polls is, where was your candidate on data centers? I think the fact that, again, both Republican and Democrat administrations, nationwide right now are doing everything they can to look like they're at least pausing, if not outright against it, tells you that both parties see it as a vulnerability.
Oh, yeah. Tom Tiffany in Wisconsin right now is running an ad about data center Crowley, labeling his Dem opponent as the data center guy. And Byron Donald,
same thing here in Texas. We're seeing
is running down in Florida, though, as anti-ban. He's saying there is no AI ban. I think, or data center ban. I think that's a stupid way to handle this. And so you're even in the Republican party, and it's the same. You're going to see these kind of splits across the way. But even in right now in the election cycle, the way it's messaged state to state is very different. And I think this is, I think, to your point, going to continue to intensify.
Oh, you're seeing an avalanche issue of data center ads for the rest of the way. Like, it's going to be.
Okay, set the line now. How many states, we can do states. Mm-hmm. How many states end up running anti-data center ads in a state? Yeah, let's say a statewide race. Let's just do statewide. So that'll leave us with governors or Senate races, not House races.
Every single one of them will.
You think all 50?
Every single one of them will. Absolutely.
Okay.
If you aren't running a data center ad, you are you should have no business being in politics. If your people aren't telling you right now to put your data center ad up and to film it and write that script right now, it is political malpractice.
All right. I think you're going to look at, I got to say, most, if not all, right? I think it's underreported. I think it's starting to get reported, but I think it's going to be the unmistakable new pocketbook issue.
This is going to be the midterm of data centers, which is not something I would have said 3 months ago.
No, not at all. All right, friend, we survived today.
We did. We survived today. We'll see what the world looks like on Thursday. It's going to be post-primary, so we'll have some stuff to talk about Florida and Alaska particularly. We'll see how it all shapes out.
And I'm looking forward to how quickly we get Florida's results this evening, because they're a state that know how to count their freaking votes.
Okay, we'll see.
Learn a thing, Dems.
See, just because you said that, we'll still be counting by the time we come back on Thursday.
I know. We're not going to have Alaska
you jinxed results. Them.
All right. Rate, review, subscribe, like, join us again. We'll be
party
here.
Party on, party animals.
Bye.